ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Without charities, some of the most vital work we need done as a society just would not happen. Think about it, from foster caring services to op shops to animal shelters, big charities and small help us out in tough times. But they're doing it tough right now too. Funding is shrinking as costs skyrocket. Hey, welcome to Big Ideas on ABC RN and ABC Listen, and its podcast, of course, everywhere. I'm Natasha Mitchell. What is the future of charity? And what makes a charity successful, even in tough times? On Big Ideas from the University of Technology Sydney's Business School, let's meet four people in the know. Dr. Lewis Wales, Course Director of the Master of Not-for-Profit and Social Enterprise, is joined by Mark Riboli, Lecturer in Social Impact and Social Change, Dr. Najmeh Hassanli, Senior Lecturer and Researcher in Social Change, Professor Bronwyn Dalton, Head of the Department of Management and CEO and Founder of Rough Sleepers, which offers pet care for people when they're homeless, and Wei Yeo, Co-Founder and CEO of the charity Umbo, providing speech pathology and occupational therapy services, and they're author of Redundant Charities. We're going to start with Bronwyn's take on what charities mean to her.
Charities is a subset, as many of you know, of the much larger not-for-profit sector. We have about 60,000 registered not-for-profits and charities in Australia across a range of different industries. But really, they're about people coming together to serve a common cause or to deliver a service or to express and advocate for social change.
Thanks, Bron. Wei, what do charities mean to you?
I am a founder of multiple charities, so been in and around the charity space for a couple of decades and seen it all and have all the battle scars to show for it. I think to add to Bronwyn's description of charities, which is really accurate, is the fact that charities are set up to achieve a purpose. So the purpose is what drives the charity. It's there to help people or planet. And it really should be about the purpose of the charity being achieved as opposed to benefiting the charity itself.
Najmeh.
Building on what my lovely colleagues here have said, charities are, to me, organizations that are mission-driven and they exist to create some sort of social value. But also, the people element in charities are very important, whether that be through the beneficiaries that they serve, because without them, the charity probably wouldn't exist. And also the public, because they contribute through volunteering their time and perhaps donating and also maybe advocating for the same cause. So the element of people, whether that be individuals or communities, is very important to charities and non-for-profits.
Mark, what do you see as what do charities mean to you?
All of the above. Maybe to expand a little bit on what other people have said, I think about two types of charities. So there's the big charities, the huge ones. We might think of, you know, the Mission Australia's, the Australian Red Cross, Oxfam, those kind of huge multinational sometimes organizations that, you know, exist for a purpose to help people. But then there's also those small community-run, community-led charities. Sometimes they run off the kitchen table of the most enthusiastic member. And so I think within, you know, from that level of a very small charity set up by neighbours to help people in a local area to, you know, your largest charities where there are, you know, you've got a CEO who's earning multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, there's a lot of variety and variability.
We are, of course, here gathered to speak about the future of charities. So one of the really important questions that we need to address is, and we'll start with Bronwyn again, what do you see as the biggest challenges facing charities today and into the future?
The biggest challenges obviously vary according to what sort of organisation. But I think overall, the biggest challenge is it is time for charities to find their own voice and a unified voice, because the current regulatory and taxation regime really prevent charities thriving. And because of our competitive contracting funding system through governments, it's tended to be a divide and conquer approach to charities. But really, if charities can unite, they can actually own their strength. Because the reality is that government needs charities more than charity needs government. But one-on-one, you're worried about your funding. But if you collectively push back, you can find greater negotiating power and to also address some of the systemic causes of the symptoms, in a sense, that you're trying to treat. So I think the biggest challenge is uniting for one voice in a system that has tried to separate you.
I think that the answer to the question depends on who you ask. So if you ask the charities themselves, they'll say, our biggest problem is not being able to raise enough money. And that's consistently what charities talk about. And they want to raise more and they want to grow. But I think from an outsider's perspective, the biggest problem facing charities is that they're not clear on what their role is. They're not clear on what they're supposed to do. And they're not clear on what they're maybe not capable of doing. So, and we've heard this before, you know, very bold vision statements of, we're going to solve world hunger. And then you go, well, okay, how much money do you raise? And they say, oh, we raise $10 million a year. And you're like, are you really going to solve world hunger on $10 million a year? So you can contribute to that problem and you can contribute to the solution. You can be part of the group that does that. But is it incumbent on charities to do all of the work? And I think that's a key argument in my book, which is, what role can charities actually play? And maybe the role of the charity is not to do the work. Maybe the role of the charity is to catalyze change. Maybe the charity is there to bring attention to the need of world hunger and then to advocate for bodies and governments to change their policies and laws to tax billionaires, for example. I don't know, crazy idea. But I think that's really important for charities to first, before they can solve any problem, work out what their role is in that problem and then play that part. And that leads on to the idea that, and again, going back to Marx's differentiation between the bigger players and the smaller community players, particularly for the bigger ones, to know that they can't be the be-all and end-all, and that making themselves redundant and being able to pull out of communities and actually empowering communities to do the work, that is really, really meaningful work. And I think that's the future of charities.
Najmi.
So my experience has mainly been with smaller community organizations, non-for-profits. So I'll look at it from that perspective. And I believe funding is a major problem, if not the most critical issue for small non-for-profits. And I like to unpack that from two different perspectives. One is, because funding bodies, and that could be either the government, corporate, it doesn't matter, they have their own agenda, they have their own purpose, they have their own mission they're trying to achieve. And so the funding that they give out aligns with their objectives. That's all good and that's understandable, but a lot of the times that doesn't necessarily align with the objectives of their small non-for-profit, which is very much along the priorities of the communities they serve. And so from a non-for-profit perspective, it's very much difficult to try to balance between these differing objectives or important issues. On one hand, the funding body, if you want to get funding, you need to make sure that you're aligning yourself with the requirements of the funding body. On the other hand, and if there is a difference between what that funding body wants and what the community's priorities are, how are you going to create that balance between the two so that you're not missing out on funding? That's one thing. And the other thing is, funding often, as we know, is very short-lived, it's very time-specific, and so a charity comes in, gets funding, offers a program, and then they have to finish off their program because the funding is finished. And so this leads to very short-term programs, offerings, services, which unfortunately may have impacts in the sense that they cannot, the non-for-profit, cannot aim for a long-term impact. And this instability can also have negative issues and negative impact on the communities that they serve as well. So from a funding perspective, these are the two main issues I see for smaller community organizations.
Building a little bit on what Najma is just saying, research suggests that approximately 10% of charities in Australia receive about 90% of the funding that's available from, you know, philanthropists and governments, and that the top 13% of the charities that they are, the top 11 or 12 charities in Australia, about 75% of their funding comes from government. So just the scale of the money that we're talking about that are going into some of these charities is quite important. And for me, the challenge is, which builds on what Wei is saying, is that the challenge for charities is to uncouple themselves from, and what they do, from the relationships that they've got with those funders, and be driven more by what they say their mission is, by the demands of the funders and what they're doing. So an example, some research that I led about the actions of nonprofits during COVID. So during COVID, there were a number of large Australian charities that when COVID hit and people were in need and, you know, people were out of work, people needed food, people needed housing, there were a number of government-funded service providers who waited. So they didn't act until they were sure what government was going to provide them to actually look after people. So you know, they were basically waiting for government to give them money to go and help people. So the smaller community-based organisations didn't wait. They just did what they could do to help the people who were around them. So that kind of, you know, attitude of waiting for government or your funder approval to do something, for me, is a big problem in the sector. And the second thing, that when that funding does come, it comes with conditions. So there's kind of one of my students, so she'd had experience of homelessness and being in the out-of-home care system, and she was saying, you know, she'd go to somewhere and they'd say, oh, we can't help you because you don't have a referral. And she'd go somewhere else and say, oh, we can't help you because you're under 18. And then if you go somewhere else, they say, oh, no, we can't help you, we only help people who are under 18. So that's kind of that the conditions under which these kind of very widget-oriented funding happens that really stops people just from getting the help they need. Whereas, you know, some of these smaller providers, you show up to the door and they say, well, can you help me out? And I'll say, well, yes, of course, because you're our neighbour and we'll do what we can even with the small things we've got. So for me, that's the biggest challenge, is to get their mind straight around what their priorities actually are.
Interesting. Thanks, Mark. We can see some really common themes there and the challenges that charities are facing. Perhaps if we could hear some examples as well, maybe from your own experience with charities, what charities do you think are likely to be those that will succeed in the future in achieving their social purpose? Bron?
The charities that I think will really thrive are those that resonate with the values and the energies of the emerging generation. And I'm talking around issues of social justice, environment, progressive causes. I was the National Manager of Research at Mission Australia and ran the National Youth Survey for many years. And it's abundantly clear, if we have over 17,000 responses, that the 14 to 19-year-old age group questioned these sort of issues, things about which they are deeply passionate. So we've got to really tap into that energy and work out a way to empower them to mobilise. And we also have to reconnect with our social movement roots. There's a reason why people take less money to work in this sector. It's because they are passionate about the social movements from which they were born, whether it's the social movements of feminism that gave women the vote, or environmentalism, or gay rights, or Indigenous rights. We've got to reconnect with that mission when we think about why we're here and what we're doing. In terms of a personal story, well, I run a charity. It's a dog washing charity for homeless people, because homeless people, if you look out there, especially staffies, they're really popular with homeless people. And we have a mobile dog washing van, and we wash the dogs and groom them. And that grew out of lived experience, or learned experience, where I saw not only so many homeless with dogs, but they were feeding their sausage, sizzle, sandwiches and things to the dogs and going hungry, but that made the dog sick and the person hungry, whereas we secured ongoing funding for very high quality dog food. So we solved dog hunger in Sydney, not necessarily, but hopefully some hunger. But in terms of conditions, sometimes our funders said, all right, but let's move the homeless on out of Sydney. They want to move them to the outskirts. So that's the kind of conditions I sometimes get exposed to.
way?
I think there's, again, a difference between the charities that on the face of it are successful and those that I truly believe are successful. So on the face of it, charities that are successful are those who get bigger and grow and can fundraise more. And if you think of the nature of a charity, the more resources you have, the more money you can put into marketing and fundraising. And therefore, you get bigger and bigger and you gain more what some charities, which I personally find a little bit offensive, say market share. So we get more of the market share of solving this problem, which isn't exactly like a collaborative approach, right, to addressing issues. So those are charities that I think are going to succeed. And, you know, Mark's already given some statistics about the share that these mega charities already have. But to me, that's not true success. I think we have to ask the question, like, what is success for a charity? And then we've got to think about, well, what are charities really? So charities are entities where they're trying to solve a problem, but they're not necessarily trying to completely solve the problem. Because if I completely solve the problem, then I'm not really needed anymore. And often with the bigger charities, there's a whole series of reasons why they have to keep going. You know, there are staff that need to be paid, and there are CEOs with big salaries. And once you have an organization that's registered, there's more to maintain, and it becomes harder and harder to dismantle. So what we do have is then charities that are addressing symptoms and not solving problems. And I would love to see more and more charities actually solve problems once and for all. And the only way that they're going to do that is by saying, we've solved it and we're not needed anymore. And that's what I term a redundant charity. So a really good example of that, before I talk about the example, it's important to know what the status quo is. So in Cambodia, where I lived for 5 years, there are so many international charities. At one point, the second highest number of international charities in the world coming into Cambodia and working there. And one of the things they commonly do is they build wells. So they'll go into communities and they'll say, look, you guys are going, you know, way too far to get drinking water. We're going to build a well in the middle of your village. And then they'll come back a year later. And of course, you know, these wells aren't being used. The local people don't know how to maintain them. They don't know how to fix them if they're broken. Perhaps it's culturally inappropriate. They just don't work. But there's a charity who was in Cambodia called Watershed. And what they did was they said to the local provincial governments, we're going to be around for 10 years. So you've got 10 years to use us for whatever it is that you want. And at the end of that, you'll be built up so that you can solve all these water issues for your constituents, for yourself. And that's a really unique and I think modern approach to charities. Don't forget, charities have barely shifted in terms of the way they operate for many, many years. So what happened at the end of this 10 years, of course, is some people were concerned that this charity would go away. And they were like, oh, you know, how are we going to do it without these Westerners helping us? But Watershed turned that around and they had a graduation party. So they had cake and alcohol and streamers and balloons. And they said, you know, now you guys have graduated from working with us. You don't need us anymore. This is a beautiful moment. And the local governor said, you know, we're not children. We don't need you. We can do this ourselves. So to me, that's a really successful charity. It's one that has gone past needing to continue themselves and has moved on to actually solving the problem and, of course, has empowered the community along the way. And that's the type of charity that I think will be more successful when we shift our view on what a standard charity should be.
I think you've spoken really well there to an organization's social purpose and making sure that always stays at the core, something that we're very consistent on in a lot of what we cover and what we teach, and making sure that the mission stays central. So it's really fascinating. Najmeh, what do you feel will make charities successful in the future?
So my work, I've been researching and doing work with non-for-profits that work with refugees in providing them with leisure services and recreational services. So in looking at those non-for-profit organizations, we found that the ones that were successful were the ones that gave a voice to the community, in this case, the refugee community. So they worked very closely with the refugee communities to identify their needs, to then be able to address it and try to address it, rather than taking a one-size-fits-all approach, thinking that, okay, if that's a need that a community elsewhere has, that's assuming that that's the same need the new community they're working with have. So working closely with the community, giving them a voice, and this could be through perhaps consultations with community leaders and elders and champions, bringing their voice in, understanding the need of the community, and then attempting to address it. What it also does is that it helps with identifying the strengths and the knowledge and the skills that the community has and building on those and leveraging from it. So to give you an example, one of the organizations we were researching and we interviewed, what they did was they had some funding to provide cricket classes to refugees from an Afghan background, so Afghani refugees. And what they did, they could have outsourced that, or they could have tried to bring someone to provide those cricket tournaments and cricket classes. But what they did through speaking with the Afghan community and the leaders, they found out that there is this Afghan group that actually does run cricket classes. So they brought them in, and they were basically running the whole show. They were from the community. They knew what the community wanted. They knew how to interact with the community. And so the program was a great success. And they were building on the asset that the community had, on the knowledge and the skills that the community had, and they were using that to then provide services to the same community. So not imposing a top-down approach, I think that's something that is very important for non-for-profits to consider, especially the community ones, and giving a voice to the community that they serve rather than, again, taking a very generic approach is very important.
Being community-led and focusing on supporting the community that they serve, I think, is very important. Mark, what do you think?
Speaking from an optimistic point of view, I guess, for me, the ones that I hope will be successful are those ones that are representative of the communities that they come out of and that do connect with people in communities. Just another quick stat about our big charities. So 11 of the 13 big charities in Australia are Christian organisations. So that's about 85% of the biggest service providers are Christian organisations. In the last census last year, only 42% of Australians said that we were identifying as Christian. So there's a little bit of a disproportion there. For me, in terms of having seen from my experience, the most effective organisations, or some of the most effective organisations, are Indigenous-led ones, like the original health services, civil society health services in Australia, the original legal aid in Australia were pioneered by Indigenous communities working together. So that's the Aboriginal Medical Service and Aboriginal Legal Service paved the way for what became legal aid, paved the way for what became Medicare and Medicaid and public health services. These were Aboriginal communities coming together, doing nation building work because they weren't getting that care from the state and kind of creating organisations themselves. An organisation I've had a bit to do with that in Mount Druitt Just Reinvest, they have a program out there called Mountie Yarns. So it's developed and run by a couple of young people out in the area, a couple of Indigenous young people out in the area who've had experience of being victimised by police, being in prison. And basically they set up a bunch of activities for young people in the area, their peers, in order to A, give them something to do that was productive, and B, at the end they'd sit around and just yarn about it, which is why it was called Mountie Yarns. It's Mount Druitt, which they call Mountie, and then Yarns is the chatting element of it. And through that, they kind of created and found shared understanding and shared stories of that kind of negative impact that they'd had, that they collectively had through the justice system. And a kind of the activities, whether they had touch football competitions, they had hip-hop workshops, they had art things. Talia, the young woman, ran makeup classes for young girls, and Isaiah, the young guy, went into some of the courts and chatted to the young guys there. And so they're just kind of giving young people things to do rather than saying, you young people should go down to the PCYC, which is run by the police, and that's where you should do your socialising. And the young Aboriginal people say, well, we don't want to go down there because the cops don't like us. Or when we go down there, they ask us about our brothers and they say, well, what's your brother up to? Because they're just trying to get them in trouble. And so the last time I was talking to Isaiah, that the young guy who's kind of running this program, he was saying, so Mark, they've been doing it for about 3 years. And he said, Mark, the first year that we ran this program, by the end of the season, so the season of 12 games or so, by the end of the season, about 70% of the guys were back inside. In the second season, maybe around 50%. And then last season, he said only one out of the 15 guys who played in the team had kind of gone back into prison. And so it's just like a you know, it's not always a linear change in that sense, but it just kind of gave me a sense that these young guys were, through that kind of peer support, peer activity, you know, making a real difference in each other's lives. And to me, that's where the future is strong, when we're kind of empowering people and giving people opportunities to create the solutions for their own problems rather than imposing those solutions from on high.
Again, really fascinating examples from everyone, and I think it really speaks to the complexity of some of the challenges that charities deal with and the social problems that they're trying to solve. And we've tackled it almost from an optimistic sense there in looking at what will make them successful, but perhaps conversely we can look at what may lead to failure for some of our charities.
Well, we've just heard some brilliant grassroots type of charity work, and yes, your mission should not be to exist, really, as Wes pointed out, but I will say that that's not where the money's flowing, and that reflects the statistics that Mark shared, and I've written about big charity, and that's where those numbers come from. The reality is, if you are to secure funding to do these grassroots activities, even if you don't believe it, you've got to be aware of the ideologies in place that shape the direction of the money and become strategic game players. So pretend to believe it. And a really short summary, top tip, the more you say you don't need government and that individualistic entrepreneurialism will lift people from poverty, the more government money you get, because it fits their predisposed narrative. So they will give something that says that they're going to turn Indigenous football players into, you know, successful business people. Then you use it to fund the football, which really works. But that's the reality. And that's why the big end of town, the big charities, get the money, because they look corporate. They look the same as the governments that are funding them. They also, from a public servant point of view, they appear to have less transaction costs. One big charity says, look, I'll solve Burke, you give me all the money, and then they just subcontract and in the process kill the smaller community-led organisations. But they do it because they play that game. And so you've got to sort of straddle saying, you know, there's some wonderful social enterprises like Street and Wayside Chapel, but the reality is it costs more to make a cup of coffee with a homeless person than the trained barista. But because they say it doesn't, and that they're making them into trained baristas, they get more government money and philanthropy. So that's the game you've sort of got to play, and all the while forming alliances to have that collective voice to actually reach for systemic change.
Thanks, Bron. That's a really important point. Wei?
Yeah, I mean, I really take Bronwyn's, I think that's a very wise approach, and it makes a lot of sense to play the game. I think my perspective is a bit different though, because you can either play the game or you can change the game, and they're your two choices, and admittedly the second one is much harder. So I'll use my own example for this one. So I lived in Cambodia for 5 years, and when I arrived in 2012, I worked in the disability sector. My background's in physiotherapy. I'd worked in China before. I thought personally I was going to work for the WHO until I realized that it just didn't really gel with my values. And when I arrived in Cambodia, people kept on saying to me, the biggest issue that people are facing in terms of kids with disabilities is the lack of speech therapy. So there are just no speech therapists in the whole country, and yet it affects over 500,000 people. In Cambodia, we have medicine as a university course, we've got nursing, we've got social work, psychology, physiotherapy, but no speech therapy. And then the question is, what were people doing about it? So it was a lot of the standard stuff. So people would give up their leave from working in a private practice clinic in Sydney, and they'd fly to Cambodia for 2 weeks, and they might do speech therapy in a village, or they train up some local people. These solutions, as Najmeh kind of said, they're external. They're top-down approaches, they're not sustainable, they don't last. For starters, speech therapy takes years to achieve any outcome, so I don't really know what a speech therapist would think would be appropriate to do in 2 weeks. But of course, this stuff looks good. It's easy to get that funded. It promotes really nicely on social media. When you post photos of a speech therapist who has a Cambodian child in their arms. That sort of stuff resonates really well. But as I said, it doesn't really produce a long-term result. And still, after decades of doing this, no Cambodian speech therapist, not one. And so the charity that I started in Cambodia, which is now being run by Cambodian people, we take the opposite approach. We think about the end solution that we want to have and the role that we want to play. And we say we're not going to do everything, but we're going to set it up to be done by the Cambodian community. So what we say is, by 2030, we will have developed 100 speech therapists and graduated them from a Cambodian university, and those people will be working within the government system. And that means that we've started the university course, which is really hard. We've created some demand for speech therapy, both from the students and from the patients. And we've got a professional body, and it's embedded within the government hospitals and government schools and government health centres. And the key thing is, when we reach this goal in 2030, we'll shut the charity down, and that will truly become a redundant charity. Now, this approach, I believe, hand on heart, will actually end up with more speech therapists being created after that. And then we'll get to the 6,000 plus that we need in Cambodia, and we'll have done the hardest bit, which is to go from zero to 100. But that work is so hard to promote, because it's the exact opposite of that volunteer example that I gave. There's no photos of me hugging Cambodian kids. There were photos of me in discussion with the Cambodian government and trying to explain what speech therapy was. There was photos of our staff signing memorandums of understanding with the university and building up their capacity to do it. And that's all in the background. So in some senses, I think often, as it is in most things in life, the most meaningful things don't play well on social media. They don't make for good TikTok videos or good Facebook posts. And often when charities are promoted really nicely on those platforms, I think you have to ask the question, is this surface level stuff, or is it actually stuff that's really creating a long-lasting impacting change? So I think in answer to the question, how are charities going to succeed or fail? The failure will occur if we keep on doing things that are meaningless. And the success will come if we actually work out that sometimes the things that are harder to do, changing the game, are worth it in a much greater capacity than those that are more surface level.
What can charities do to future-proof themselves and thrive in the future, Bronwyn?
Well, I'm a great advocate for robust measuring of social impact, starting with a great, succinct, achievable, realistic theory of change, exactly as Wei has put it. Like, he'd get an A+ for that theory of change. So many theories of change. I mean, talk about set up to fail. We do it with Indigenous organisations all the time, that what their mission is to close the gap, and they're running a midnight basketball competition. Oh, the Afghans, they're to bring peace to the Middle East. Well, you know, good luck with that. Another one, end world hunger. These sort of huge missions. So very defined missions. But there's a couple of issues that I am worried about in the new emphasis on measuring social impact. One is, we are still only valuing what we measure, but we do not measure what is most valuable. What's really overtaking evaluation at the moment and measuring social impact is a huge pressure on charities to prove savings to government. So, and I get asked a lot, and I do a lot of evaluations, do a social return on investment. With every dollar spent on this homeless person, how much will the government save? In particular, and we gravitate to this because it's costed, do we keep them out of accident and emergency and hospital, and do we keep them out of prison because it costs $800 a night for a bed in hospital and whatever in prison? This narrative, I really believe in the ability of an investment to save money to government from 0 to 5 years old. If you invest then, you can change the trajectory of how a person may or may not use government services. If you are homeless, and I was involved in the Michael and Misha homelessness programs that evaluating them for Mission Australia, what a good intervention does is, first of all, go to the guy in Hyde Park, which we literally did, and offered them a house, except for the ones who owned dogs and they weren't allowed, hence I started my other charity. But first of all, you give them housing, a caseworker, then you realise they're not on disability, so you get them sorted out with that. Then you have to do wraparound other support services. But no, and yes, they don't go to hospital as often and they don't get involved with the justice system, but the cost of the house in Sydney will never. So I left that out of the calculation. That's the strategic game player part. Because we're coming from a place where, you know, there's this myth that you can make money helping people. Well, you know, we've had a capitalist system for a long time and no one's solved it yet. So I'm wondering really if we should start from that premise and accept that doing good costs money, and particularly in the homeless space, as soon as you give a house to someone in Sydney, I don't care if they're in Long Bay for the rest of their life, but Sydney house prices will blow out any social return on investment. So that's my concern.
Najma.
I go back to what I said before around working with community. So again, in the context of grassroots and small-based community organizations, non-for-profits, working with the communities, giving them a voice is really, really important. And as Wei was saying, sometimes a non-for-profit doesn't have to do all the work themselves. So in knowing how the community can support and provide support and offering them to do some of the work is very important, similar to the example that I gave. The cricket tournaments were run by a community group. And what that organization did on the side was to provide the safety framework around crisis management, maybe something that the community organization didn't necessarily have a knowledge of. Or what they did was to provide access to facilities, again, something that the non-for-profit organization could help them with. So stepping aside and allowing the community to take control and ownership where possible and doing the things that they may need support with and engaging on those type of work, I think is very important. Also, as an academic, I'd like to talk about the role that academics play. Again, in our study, we found that in the non-for-profit sector, there's a lack of longitudinal and comparative studies. And this is where I think we as academics can come into play and we can support and help and non-for-profits to perhaps do some rigorous research and maybe fill the gap in terms of doing some longitudinal and comparative studies, which are not easy. But that's a very big gap in the sector as well. So,
and Mark?
I might return to a point that Bron made a bit in the beginning about that kind of collective power of the sector. You know, when we're talking about charities, we're talking about civil society. It's all about people working together collectively. So for me, it's about the sector as a whole finding power through kind of making demands on government. And for me, it's about three key things there. The first one is about diversification of the sector. It's not good for anyone if our charity sector is like the supermarket sector. You know, we don't want all of the power and all the services being delivered by a few. We want to have local community-run services. So, you know, if it's a strong message coming out of the sector as a whole about that, I think it's really good and important. The second one is around demanding of government that we stop just focusing on the crisis end of the system. The government is obsessed with direct service delivery and just fixing the crisis things, but we're not then thinking about the causes. We're not thinking about those 0 to 5 age groups. We're not actually stopping more people coming into crisis. So I think that's a really powerful message that the sector needs to send. And it's a really hard one to send because it kind of goes a little bit against their own self-interest to say, well, actually, can you stop funding us for this? Because we'd rather do capacity building in communities and support these communities to do things for themselves. And the last one, which is a really tricky one, is to fight against that idea that the charity sector or the care sector or society should be organized around kind of individualized payments and punishments and transactions and shift to something around like a collective and community sense of care. Because that's where all of these charities started up as, you know, whether they started 100 years ago or whether they started last week. It's about a group of people coming together because they care about a community. And so it's not about widgets and counting and individuals, it's about community. And I know, having talked to people across the whole sector, that everyone believes that. They all care about it. People aren't in the not-for-profit sector because they don't care, they do. But really pushing that message and getting that out there is, I think, something that we really have to get on top of.
We've had a very fascinating discussion, but we now have an opportunity to ask questions.
I guess it's tapping into what you've all been saying in different ways, which is this tension between the professionalisation of charity work and then the human spirit that takes us to do charity work. And I'd love to hear a little bit more of your thoughts around the type of skills that are most important to bring into this space, the type of people and attitudes, and also maybe how long we should be working in the space. Maybe it is a tap in, tap out. Maybe we do get burnt out if we're doing it as a profession. Maybe if we do it from 9 to 5, we don't want to go and volunteer a couple of hours after that. Whereas if we're doing it as a profession and volunteering, it's a very different experience.
Well, I think the strongest skill you can have is a set of really sharp advocacy skills. And that means also building alliances. We've got to counteract this divide and conquer competitive tendering approach. And I'll give an example. As people in different services often find, the funding stays the same, yet the need grows exponentially, and you're finding yourself in a situation where your funder, and usually in Australia it's the government, isn't actually covering the cost of delivering the service anymore. You've been subsidising with volunteers and donations, but even that won't cover it. This happened with a mental health program in Queensland, and they put out another tender, and it wasn't nearly enough to cover the type of service the government was requiring. What the individual mental health providers did, not-for-profit providers did, was meet separately and all agree that they'd only do it for this new price. And they held together and they linked arms. And it turns out the Queensland government needed a mental health service more than the mental health services needed Queensland government. So it's finding your power and getting those organised, grassroots organising skills, working out what strategies really work. And in your toolkit, you can have, you know, social media campaigning skills, you can have community building skills, you can have charismatic leadership skills, all help to build a sense of unity to push back and make the conditions more sustainable for charities. But on a personal level, look after yourself too, because honestly, social workers give a lot, but there's a thing called care fatigue, and it's really real. And we ask so much of these people to expose themselves to people who need them so much. I do believe that sometimes it's time to just take a step out for a while or take on other roles, because it is it's a very demanding role, and all respect and power to those people, and we should really give them a chance to have a break.
I mean, I'd love to be working around this sector for the rest of my life, and I think people can, but I think you've got to maybe move around and do different types of things, because just working in social work for a while or just working with a particular type of community can get into that kind of care fatigue. You don't see a lot of care for staff going along in organisations. You definitely don't see it in political organisations. You do get it in, so the legal sector and some of the social work sectors are now starting to have mentoring and trauma feedback practices to actually protect those workers, because it is, you know, it's quite a vulnerable situation. In terms of the skill, for me, the first skill that you need, and if you don't have this, you shouldn't be working in the sector, is empathy. If you don't have that, then just get out and go and work for the Commonwealth Bank.
Yes, another question here.
Thanks very much for the presentation. I was wondering if you could provide more thoughts about the importance of measuring impact, in particular for small charities. That's something that you always get asked, how are you measuring your impact? You also know that impact measurement is like very expensive. That can take half of your budget, can take all of your budget. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, look, there's this whole industry out there of consultants that are ripping the sector off at the moment, and they wouldn't get an A+ for their methodology. They've just got really good graphics, right? The key is to build the capacity of the sector and to democratise the access to the tools needed to measure social impact. Even then, though, evaluation is expensive. The sector, one of a great sort of whole of sector campaign should be, if you want evaluation, pay for it. They want you to spend 100% of your funding on the service delivery, and then they go, oh, now where's your evaluation? So really, that should be part of all contracts. They should never be able to ask you to do an evaluation. And the final thing is also, and it relates to this self-care, my concern is that they ask the social worker to then turn around and do a questionnaire with all of their clients after they've delivered all their services, which makes the results invalid because of power difference. But park that. It's another imposition on really overworked frontline workers. So the cheapest and the best and the most sensible thing to do is to just make sure your program is evidence-based. It'll have a far better chance of succeeding. As long as you can go to a library or find some research that says that what you're doing is evidence-based, that is a minimum that I think would help everybody. And also all join together and advocate for people to pay for evaluation rather than imposing it on the front line.
I'm Srimanto. So can charity be considered as the triggering point rather than a continuous feed to the system, and the end receiver can be self-reliant? But I think that is where sustainability will be there.
The question is the role of the charity to continue delivering the services and to keep people subjugated to the power imbalance that charities have? When you're a recipient of something that's free, you're not allowed to complain. And people will take free things on and never use them. So there's an example in Cambodia of a charity that made wheelchairs, and they did a study later on these wheelchairs in the houses, and they were being used as pieces of furniture by the people who could walk. So if someone turns up at your house with something that looks like a chair, you're probably going to take it and use it, but it's not the original intention. So I think when you have the idea that a charity is there to instigate the change, as you said, and if that charity ends, there are three outcomes after that. So they hand off to... Sorry, there's four outcomes. There's I hand the solution off to the local government. That's what we're doing in Cambodia. We're saying, you know, government, you've got the resources to build this profession. The second one is we hand off to private sector. So we stimulate private sector demand and then people pay for it. The third one is we hand it off to a local civil society organization. So a local charity that's locally run, maybe doesn't require fundraising. And the fourth one is nothing. Like, we've solved the problem. So that's something like polio, for example, where there's nothing that's needed afterwards because the solution has been given.
Yeah, also, we've only been really talking about charities in the sense of service providers a lot of the time here. And that's not the entirety of the not-for-profit sector by any means. So, you know, there's also your interest group organizations who largely do that advocacy for systemic change, who are trying to kind of change minds and hearts and government policy. And then you've also got the less funded but no less important community development organizations whose focus isn't necessarily on delivering services or advocating for change, but they're aim is to build capacity within communities so that they can deal with those challenges themselves. And so a lot of the examples in Australia, the successes of the feminist movement was around community development organisations and community development groups, feminist community doing community organising around Redfern, which led to, you know, funding for women's shelters and things like that. So it's not, the answer is not social enterprises. It's just there's a lot of different types of things that I think charities can do. And you know, in the UK, they say charities for the whole sector. In Australia, we say not for profit. In the US, they say non-profit. Like everyone has a different name for a piece of string. But for me, they're kind of like talking about organizations inside civil society, and they can do a lot of different things.
I get a bit concerned to kind of summarize, don't give a man a fish, teach him how to fish. Which is a very common, it's very big in the microfinance industry. Now, we were describing those old white guys that are our philanthrocapitalists, and sure, in their head, they, you know, came from nothing and built themselves up and they became successful entrepreneurs. And all these people who need some sort of support, inside them is a budding Bill Gates. Well, actually, Bill Gates had access to a computer and he was born at a time when the computing age took off. It's luck and it's birth and it's access to systems. And the idea, this whole teach them how to fish, I fear, has a deeper narrative that if you don't pull yourself up by your own bootstraps, it's your fault. It individualizes poverty as a failure of an individual. The reality is the microfinance is really based on this. Not Yunus, he's amazing, and he had a not-for-profit model, but now it's been corporatized. It's been giving micro loans out, and the microfinance industry is responsible for the eviction of more poor people than any other movement in the history of the world because they couldn't make their loans and make a profit on it. So really, we should clean up the water that he needs to fish from. We should educate his children so they don't have to be fishermen anymore. True, we don't want to create a culture of dependency, but we don't want to create a culture of blame, because the issues of poverty are deeply systemic.
Hi, I'm curious about, for the organisations or not-for-profits or charities that are already going and already doing stuff, and if they're wanting to change their mindset to be change agents, and if that's the purpose of what a charity should really be, to become redundant, these organisations that are already doing stuff, that's a massive mindset change for them. And that's brave, and that's got to take a lot of courage and a lot of change. How do they do that? Where do they start? What can you offer in terms of tips and guidance for what they should be doing for the next 12 months to be that change?
So my general answer is it's got to come from the board and the governance of the organisation and wanting to do it. Asthma Australia, for example, 10 years ago there was Asthma New South Wales, Asthma Queensland, Asthma Victoria, Asthma ACT, and they were kind of a federated group of organisations. Now, about 5 years ago, they shifted to be just Asthma Australia. And they did that because the board got together and the organisations got together and they said, well, asthma's not really an isolated issue anymore. People know about it. What are we doing? And so they consulted with their members and they consulted with the community and they consulted with researchers. And they said, well, should we shut down and just kind of like redistribute our assets to other related charities, which some charities do? And the member said, well, no, actually, we want you to use that clout you have to kind of work with communities to do other things. And so they became just Asthma Australia, and now they only work in partnership with other different organisations. And so they work with local communities, for example, in places where they're building toll roads, and so they're worried about the exhaust and what impact that might have on lungs, so, you know, around mining communities in the Hunter. So they kind of do research and partnership around that. So, but it comes from the top, I think. There are processes that organisations can do to kind of consult with their members to ask them what is the role for the organisation in the future. But that's brave, and it requires, you know, leadership, good leadership at a governance level.
Very quickly, I think charities have to face reality, which is that they do shut down. So particularly international charities, the research suggests that there are two key reasons why charities leave a country like Cambodia or Nepal. The reasons are, one, donor government doesn't like host government. So Australian government gives the money, we're not friends with the Cambodian government anymore, we're going to cut the funding. The second one is similar, money runs out, so we just can't fundraise anymore. Now, both of these reasons are external reasons, things that happen to us, not within our locus of control. So my point is, if it's going to happen anyway, we might as well make it a decision that is within our control. We set the timing, we set the situation, and really importantly, we don't leave the community we're working with alone. We don't leave them in the lurch. We actually set it up from the beginning so that when we leave, because it's not if, it's when we leave, they can do it by themselves.
Charities and their future in lean times. From the UTS Business School, you heard from Mark Riboldi, Dr. Najmeh Hassanli and Professor Bronwyn Dalton, who also runs the charity Rough Sleepers. The moderator was Dr. Lewis Wales. And Wei Yeo, CEO of the charity Umbo, which provides online speech pathology and occupational services, was part of the conversation. I'm Natasha Mitchell. Find Big Ideas over on the ABC Listen app. Be sure to do that. Just search for us, Big Ideas, and hit follow. And that way you can catch all our podcasts. I'm really looking forward to joining you next episode for more live events with big thinkers and their big ideas.
It's easier than ever to hear your favourite local and national ABC radio stations live and on demand on the ABC Listen app.